Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a deep dive into Phoenix's water future as we face one of the longest stretches without rain in our city's history. And AI is coming to the movies, but isn't ready for its close-up. But first, lawmakers are back at the state capitol and a new legislative session has begun, this time with an emboldened GOP in control of both chambers and up against a Democratic governor who is not afraid to use her veto stamp. And one of the top priorities on the legislature's to-do list may already be at a standstill, renewing Prop 123. That is the measure that voters narrowly approved back in 2016 to take money from state trust land to boost K-12 schools. It expires in July. Governor Katie Hobbs called for lawmakers to extend it in her State of the State speech on Monday, but Republican lawmakers are not rushing to renew it. Here with more on that and how the new session is shaping up is our politics, both of them, politics desk here, Wayne Shetsky and Cameron Sanchez. Good morning to you both. Happy
morning.
New session.
Hi.
Everybody ready? Okay. So, Wayne, let's start with you and Prop 123 here. This is one of the things that lawmakers kind of have to do or should do this session, right? But it's already looking like it might be a tough road.
Yeah. As you mentioned, it was passed in 2016. It expires after 10 years at the end of this fiscal year and over the summer. And what has to happen to renew it is lawmakers have to come up with a proposal on how craft the proposition and then send it to voters. It ultimately has to be approved by them. In order to get passed before it expires, it actually has to go to voters in a special election in May. Mm-hmm. And, you know, elections can't just happen with a snap of your fingers, so they have to actually get this done in the next few weeks if they want to give election officials time to put that on the ballot.
So it's actually something that has to be done pretty quickly.
Yeah, but based on the comments they're making, it doesn't sound like they're in a rush to actually get that done. They've been working on this for over a year, but Democrats and Republicans have very different ideas on kind of how much money should be attached to this and exactly what it should be used for, whether it's just teacher raises or whether it's a whole host of educational expenses.
This was something they tried to do, couldn't agree upon last session either, right? Everybody kind of seemed to have their own plan or how this should be renewed.
Yeah, Republicans actually introduced their idea in, I think, like November or December 2023 ahead of the last session. And then Democrats kind of came and Governor Hobbs came back with their own ideas. And Like I said, they all seem to agree that it should be renewed, but how it's renewed and what that exactly looks like, they still seem to be a bit far apart.
Okay. What happens, Wayne, if they do not put this on the ballot for voters before it expires?
So it's not like the money just goes away immediately. A piece of the law says that if it doesn't go to voters, if it doesn't get renewed, then the approximately $300 million that would go to K-12 public schools next year, mm-hmm. if it were renewed, has to be backfilled by the general fund. And so for the non-budget wonks out there, essentially what that means, that's the big pot of money that most of the rest of the services from the government is paid for. So they're going to be taken from a different pot of money. But what that means is that $300 million that maybe could have gone to some other expense somewhere else in the state government now won't be paid for.
Yeah. Okay. Cameron, let's turn to you and talk about one area where the governor and the GOP legislature might have found some agreement. The governor talked a lot about affordable housing in her State of the State address on Monday. And one program that she wants to extend, which is the low income housing tax credit. It sounds like she might have some GOP support there. Is that right?
Yeah, just a glimmer of hope at the end of a long, dark tunnel, I think. So this is the concept of low income housing tax credits, which is also commonly referred to as LIHTC. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's come up in recent sessions, but not been like the focus of housing policy. And the reason it's maybe possible is because I know that at least one Republican, Jeff Weninger, is in favor of LIHTC. And that's something that he's talked about a lot in the past. And he gets to lead the House Commerce Committee. So the House Commerce Committee and the Senate Commerce Committee, Senate changed it up, but basically they address the housing bills. And so if a housing bill is making its way through the process of becoming a law, it really has to stop off there. Okay. And the chairs have a lot of discretion about what gets to go through. And since he's a fan of LIHTC, it seems like a promising thing. And he said he's already been in touch with the governor's office about LIHTC in particular.
What exactly would this do? How would it help folks?
Well, LIHTC means tax breaks for developers who set aside units for affordable housing.
Right.
So you have a certain amount of units set aside for people who make a certain income, which is low. And the idea is that it would increase the affordable housing supply and help out with Arizona's affordability crisis.
Okay. So we are really looking at a divided session here, obviously, not just between the governor and the legislative majority, it sounds like, but also within the Republican Party itself, even though they have this kind of even bigger majority than they did last session. We saw the Freedom Caucus hold its own press conference this week to announce its own agenda. It sounds like they really kind of talked about themselves as their own entity, right?
Yeah, they kind of came out and they, you know, they did not show up to the House Republicans press conference, as you mentioned, and they laid out their own priorities, which seemed to squarely center on disrupting Governor Katie Hobbs' agenda and getting her unelected or beat her in the next election. Mm-hmm. And same with Adrian Fontes and Chris Mays. They also put up their own person that they want to run for chair of the party. So, yeah, a lot of divisions within the Republican Party stemming from that Freedom Caucus split with, I guess, the more traditional Republicans, the major wing of the party.
Right. And that's nothing new. But how might it affect the session GOP priorities going forward? Like, can they come together to do what they want to do when they have such a majority?
What happens is Republicans increase their majority. They have a few seats now. But yeah, if they can't get those Freedom Caucus members on board in either house, they account for several seats in both chambers, then they're going to have to turn to Democrats to get those votes if we're looking to pass something like the budget, which they've had to do in years past because Freedom Caucus members wouldn't get on board. So even though it looks like Republicans have kind of solidified control of both chambers, this kind of fracturing nature of their caucus shows that, as Democrats pointed out at the start of the session, they might have to turn to Democrats for votes again.
Okay, and we'll talk about Democrats in just a moment. But let me ask first about what you mentioned there briefly, which is that there are reports now that there are, you know, sort of internal battles going on for who will be elected the next chair of the Arizona GOP. What does that look like, and what might it mean for the party going forward?
Well, the current chair is Gina Swoboda, and she is thought to be somewhat successful because the Republicans just had this huge sweeping victory in the last election. They won almost everything significant that they went for. But that doesn't mean that everyone is behind Swoboda to be the next chair of the party. Even though she had that, and even though she had Trump's endorsement,
right,
there is still some division and fracturing, and the so-called Freedom Caucus type Republicans are putting up their own candidate. And that is, you know, it remains to be seen. It also, I think, is worth mentioning that the Freedom Caucus put up their own candidate to run against Leo Biasucci and Steve Montenegro for House Speaker. So even within, like, the state House leadership elections, there was a fracture and they had their own candidate run.
Okay. So let's end with a question or two about the Democratic Party as well and what they're looking like heading into this session. They're coming off pretty major losses in November. Where do they stand?
Yeah, and so we're kind of seeing the inverse. They have coalesced behind Chair Yolanda Bejarano, who oversaw the party during those, you know, several key losses in legislative races and some other races across the state. But, you know, we're not seeing the same talk like we're seeing on the Republican side, where an alternative candidate is being put up. The last time around, there was kind of a fight between Maricopa County Supervisor Steve Gallardo and Bejarano to see who would lead the party, with officials on backing both. But now we're seeing basically all major Democrats backing Bejarano.
Is that going to help them? Are they expecting to be able to, you know, do much when they don't have a majority in either chamber here?
They're two separate things. I think the idea is that, you know, consistency will breed success, that, you know, infighting and all that kind of stuff is only going to hurt them more going into the future from the party standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned before, Democrats at the legislature believe they have an in to kind of apply some leverage for their own priorities, given that they have a fracture on the Republican side. So if you want our votes to pass your budget, Speaker Montenegro and Senate President Peterson, then you're going to have to give in on some of the things we want to get done.
All right. We will see how it all plays out. That is KJZZ's Politics Desk, Wayne Shutsky and Cameron Sanchez. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
During the pandemic, more kids missed more school than they had pretty much ever before. But one population in particular, that trend has only gotten worse for them in the years since. A new investigation by the Associated Press and Chalkbeat found that Native American students are more likely to be chronically absent from school today. Way more likely, in fact. This was true to some extent before the pandemic, but now most states saw absenteeism rates for Native students that were at least 9 percentage points higher than the state average. college. In Arizona, they found chronic absenteeism for Native students rose from 22% before the pandemic to 45% last year in the 2022-2023 school year. Kaylin Belsha is national reporter for Chalkbeat, and I spoke with her more about it.
So for most states, the definition of chronic absenteeism is a student who's missed 10% or more of the school year, which in most cases is around 18 days, which adds up to a month of school.
Wow. Okay. And I'm assuming that that has pretty obvious and detrimental, you know, impacts on that kid's education.
Yeah, there's a lot of research that has shown when kids miss that kind of school, they fall behind. They're missing the kinds of crucial supports that they can get, either mental health services, if they are getting special education services, you know, anything that you can get in person when you're not at school, you're not getting that.
Yeah. Okay. So chronic absenteeism really went up during the pandemic for obvious reasons, I think. But you have found that those rates really haven't gotten a lot better since. Like, this continues to be a big problem for schools across the country, it sounds like.
Yeah, and this is something that confused a lot of schools. I think people thought that when the pandemic went away, that we would see this go back down to pre-pandemic rates. And schools really saw kind of a level of disengagement that they hadn't seen in the past. Students and families that felt like they didn't have to go to school as often, that they could do their work from home. A lot of assignments were still available online, so kids were kind of doing their work remotely like they had during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We also saw families were really concerned about illness in ways that maybe they wouldn't have kept their kid home before, and they had a cold, and so they kept them home.
Yeah.
And so kids were staying home for illness more often, too.
Yeah. But in this piece, you and several other reporters here look at the data around the country and found that this is especially true for Native American students. Much worse, in fact, for this particular population. Tell us what that looks like. What's the data look like on that?
So before the pandemic, Native American students missed school at higher rates too. But we found that when we looked at kind of how it had changed from before the pandemic to the year after the pandemic, the rates for Native American students stayed much higher. In many, many states, it was 9 percentage points higher than the state average, which is quite high. And in at least two dozen states, the rate for Native American students went up much quicker than it did for the state. So that means that Native American students were just missing more school more often than other kids.
Hmm. So why? What are the reasons cited for Native American students being, you know, this disproportionately affected?
Yeah, some of it definitely had to do with the disengagement that we heard about that's affecting students kind of across the board. Some of it has to do with a historic distrust that many Native American families have for their schools and maybe not feeling like their school is very welcoming to them. Mm. A lot of Native American students live in more rural or isolated communities that transportation is needed to get to school. And so we heard, you know, if a kid missed the bus, that was kind of it. We heard from a lot of teachers that some kids were sleeping in. Maybe they had stayed up late on social media or playing video games and then they missed their transportation. And then there's also, we heard some students kind of feeling a sense of disengagement or anxiety after they fell behind at school during the pandemic.
So hard to catch up.
Yeah, exactly.
How do these issues of poverty play into this? You mentioned the rural aspect a lot of this and also the kind of troubled history, the history of, you know, Native American boarding schools, abuse, et cetera. But I wonder, like, is it as simple as, like, you know, not having a ride to school, not having clean clothes to wear?
Yeah, those can both be definitely those can both be issues that we heard about. And I think that there's other issues, too, when a family doesn't maybe have the same resources to offer catch-up services for their child, or if a family is struggling with food insecurity or the family needs to work and the older student is tapped to watch their younger siblings. Mm. These are all kind of stemming from poverty that can affect a child's attendance rates.
Right. Okay, so let's zoom in and talk about Arizona here. We saw chronic absenteeism, you report, go up here up to 45% in the 2022-2023 school year. The worst example, it sounds like, was in the San Carlos Unified School District, which is near the San Carlos Reservation in eastern Arizona. Tell us what's happening there.
Yeah, so that is a district with a superintendent who knew that this was something they really wanted to focus on, and she's been really conscious of trying to do kind of more culturally relevant instruction, bringing more activities in that are relevant for Native kids and families. But one thing that they tried was introducing what they called care centers. And so these were places that would offer kind of more primary care and mental health support for students and families. And they said that they felt like this really did help because it encouraged people to come back into the buildings. It gave them a way to get people in the door if they said that they weren't feeling well. And it also gave staff a chance to form a relationship with students and families. And so it kind of served on lots of different ways that it could help improve attendance.
Did they see it work? I mean, like, these are not the approaches I would have assumed you'd take, right? Like, this is much more, it sounds like, community-based.
Yeah, they did see their chronic absenteeism rate go down after they installed this. And I think it's not the only thing they think helped. They think it was kind of a constellation of things that they tried. But they do think that these healthcare options helped a lot with attendance.
That's really interesting. Tell us a little bit about some of the other ideas that you report on that schools are coming up with around the country to try to fix this particular issue. It sounds like lots of innovative approaches are being tried.
Yeah, I heard a combination of both like new things schools were trying and then also doubling down on old things that they know kind of work. A lot of schools told me that they were adding more events at the school that would encourage families to come in. So either like open school nights, festivals, things where it would encourage students and families to stay at the school. I heard that that was something that kind of created a more welcoming environment. I also heard that schools were trying things around transportation that they hadn't tried in the past. One school district told me that they actually started partnering with the tribal education liaison, and anytime a student on the reservation missed the bus, they had somebody else who would take them to school. So there was kind of a standby, somebody who was volunteering to make sure that they would take the child to school. In other states, I also have heard about parents volunteering to walk kids to school to make sure that they have someone who is like watching out for them and might knock on their door if they, you know, didn't wake up on time. So there's just kind of like, it often looks like more adults paying really close attention and really focusing on this.
Yeah.
And I've also heard that a lot of school districts are just really paying attention to kind of warning signs in their data. So instead of waiting for the child to be missing a lot of school, like if they've missed maybe 1 or 2 days, they start calling the family, seeing what's going on. Is there anything that they can do? And trying to make sure families know it's not a punitive thing. I know for Native American families, that was really important. Like they don't want to hear that protective services or police mightn't get involved because that has happened in the past. So the school has to really kind of emphasize, like, we're here to help and we're really trying to like just get you the support that you need.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there. Kaylin Belsha, national reporter for Chalkbeat, telling us more about her story here. Kaylin, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, AI-generated movies are making their debut in Hollywood. How much will they change the film industry? But first, it is dry out there. Really dry. The last time it rained in Phoenix was August 22nd. That was 145 days ago, which means we are in the third longest dry streak in our city's history. The National Weather Service told me a few more weeks and we'll break the record. And it's not just Phoenix. Across Maricopa County, we're seeing severe to extreme drought reported. But our next guest says when it comes to our city's water supply, it doesn't really matter, at least not yet. Cynthia Campbell is the City of Phoenix's Water Resources Management Advisor, and she told me while one dry winter isn't dire for our city's water supply, a few more, and we could be looking at a big problem. Here's our conversation in today's deep dive.
In the short term, it's not really that enormous of an effect because our water comes primarily from surface flows, right? From the mountains and the White Mountains and the Mogollon Rim, as well as the Colorado River. And in both instances, those are bounded by reservoirs. Mm-hmm. And reservoirs are designed for this purpose, right? When you have dry parts of time, then you pull on the reservoir a little more. And when you have wet times, you capture the excess in the reservoir to wait for the times when it's drier. So in the short term, you know, our system, especially our local system run by SRP, is operating quite well. Mm-hmm. And our reservoirs are in good condition. And so when you go through these kind of prolonged times of no rain, yes, it impacts the reservoir, but you won't see that impact maybe immediately. It really only starts to show up in a meaningful way when you get very prolonged dry periods. And then you start looking about, well, what about next year?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Okay. So we're at a situation now where we had a couple of wet winters and springs ahead of this, the last, I think, 2 years, where we got lucky. We got a lot of rain, right?
Right.
And that has not happened this year. But you're saying it would need to happen again and again and maybe again before we'd really see much impact?
Well, it might not take that many times of
not
dryness.
Many again.
I mean, even this year, if we really don't get any more precipitation, or really, and for us also, it's not just whether it rains in Phoenix. In fact, it matters very little whether it rains in Phoenix. What really matters is whether it snows in the White Mountains, if it snows on the rim, if it snows, those are our watersheds. That's where the water really comes from.
Right.
But if it doesn't snow in those places and we get through the winter, through March, and we don't have measurable precipitation in those areas, yeah, there will be implications for that for the reservoirs, because it's going to push those reservoirs down as we go through the summer and we draw on them, because that's when we use more water, is when it gets hot.
Yeah.
Then you're going to see it. So when we come around, if that all happens, if we come around to the fall and next winter, then the reservoirs are going to be lower, and we're going to be more critically looking to what's the precipitation next winter.
So that, 1 year out, it's looking, it could affect.
It could have an impact 1 year out, but we're not at that point yet in the winter where we have to say, oh, this winter's already shot.
Okay. So, so let's say that happens. Let's say next winter's dry too. It very well could be. What do we do? What are our backup supplies?
I'm really glad you asked that question. You know, one of the things about the way that the Salt River Project operates the reservoirs in Arizona, in this part of Arizona, is that they use a process that they call conjunctive management. So basically, they have this surface water that sits in these reservoirs, but they also rely upon groundwater that is beneath our feet here in the Phoenix metro area.
Right.
And so they have the ability to pull groundwater. And SRP has a very elaborate plan that as to when the reservoirs go low, they basically turn on the multiple wells that they've got throughout that part of the valley, and they start pulling groundwater a little more than they would in years when the reservoirs are full. And that way they can kind of balance out the two.
Okay.
And if that happens next winter or the winter after, there is a plan. If it was really something that went on long, long term, and we really draw those reservoirs down over the long term, yeah, we get to be, that gets to be problematic. The other challenge that presents itself when we start driving our local reservoirs down is for many cities like Phoenix, we have what we call our alternate supplies stored in those reservoirs as well. This is water that can be used anywhere in the city of Phoenix, and it's water that we intend to use when, not if, when we face Colorado River shortage beginning potentially as early as January of 2027.
Right. And we can pretty much count on getting some cuts to our Colorado River supply as the deals that should be crafted soon are going to be hammered out here. Like we should expect cuts.
Without a doubt.
Okay, so you just outlined a whole lot of backup systems we have and backup systems for the backup systems, because we are a desert city and the people who planned water here have been planning it that way for a long time. But there has to be sort of an end point, I wonder. And like, what does that look like? Because we are facing a drier and warmer future, and we're facing unprecedented growth. We're still one of the fastest growing places in the country, more and more people coming here. How do we balance these things?
So we balance them by using greater water efficiency. And water efficiency can mean a couple different things. So, for example, you know, if you're still using water to wash your driveway or to spray your sidewalks, that's really probably not the best use of water. If you're using water in a way where you're overwatering your desert xeriscape, or maybe you're watering grass that really doesn't have a particular purpose. On the other side of the scale, in industrial processes, what we're starting to see a lot more is that industrial customers are using and recycling water as they use it. So they'll use it in whatever their process is, but they'll build their own plants and they actually recycle it on site and use it over again. So the ultimate net use of water is less. That's helpful. And of course, Phoenix is very actively working toward advanced water purification, where we are actually recycling our own water use in terms of our domestic water use. Our wastewater can be turned back into drinking water through a process of advanced water purification.
So lots of ways in which we can do that. And we'll talk more about it all in just a moment. That is Cynthia Campbell, Water Resources Management Advisor for the City of Phoenix, talking to us about this winter's drought and the water implications here in Phoenix. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. And let's return now to my conversation with City of Phoenix Water Resources Management Advisor Cynthia Campbell. We're talking about the drought we're seeing in Arizona this winter and what it might mean for us here in Phoenix. And I wonder, because this is the question that inevitably comes up when you have this conversation with people about Phoenix's water future. There's an assumption that there's no way this city can sustain itself going forward. I think you probably heard plenty of that. But there is also an assumption that at some point we'll all be asked to conserve water in the way that you just kind of talked about, but maybe in more severe ways where, you know, we're seeing what we saw in California, where people are being, you know, told you can only water your lawn these times or this often, or you shouldn't have one, you have to get rid of it. When do those kinds of like mandatory kind of conservation requirements come into play, or do they in your mind?
Well, absolutely, they could come into play. I think that's another, you've offered another example of what I would put under the very broad category of water efficiency. What we would like to see happen is that if we can educate people and familiarize them with ways that they can use water more efficiently, that they would do that on a voluntary basis.
Yeah.
The reason being is because when you're doing it voluntarily, when you make a choice to do something a certain way, then it kind of sticks with you. You adopt that practice, you adopt that type of use. And in doing that, that kind of feeds into what we've always called in Phoenix a culture of conservation, right? People need to think about water all the time and try to make their own adjustments in ways that make their water use more efficient. If we have to get to the point where we start talking about mandatory or non-voluntary mm-hmm. ways to conserve water, that's certainly something that we can contemplate. That's something we've seen done, obviously, in other places in the country. The problem sometimes with that, though, is that for many people, and we've seen this play out in California, for many people, they look at those kinds of things that are mandatory and they say to themselves, well, you must be imposing this on me because it's an emergency. Mm. When is the emergency over? And they're looking for the end date. Right. They're looking for the time when they can, quote, go back to the way they used to do things.
Right.
And what we're saying is that we would much rather people come to the conclusion that, hey, look, it's going to benefit me. It's going to benefit my neighbors. It's going to benefit my community if I act like I live in the Sonoran Desert and I start using water in a more efficient way.
Do you think we do that here? I mean, like, I know you've talked before about, you know, Phoenix has gotten a lot better over the last couple of decades in using less water. But I wonder, like, is that message around? Like, do you see, are there billboards, PSAs? Like, do we talk about this a lot in Phoenix? I don't hear it a lot where it's like, oh, we all need to take shorter showers or get rid of our lawns. Like, I'm not sure we think we live in a desert in that way.
Well, I would kind of push back on that and say, I think absolutely we've seen that.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the way that the Phoenix area was settled and growth developed immediately after World War II, right? We sold ourselves as a desert oasis. People put in palm trees and they put in these lush lawns and they put in all of these non-native plants. And they said, you know, heck, if you could water it, you can grow anything here,
yeah.
Which is true.
Yeah.
You can. But, you know, they kind of created an oasis in the middle of the desert. And if you look at Phoenix today, you know, I mean, you can still see historic neighborhoods that were originally built with that purpose, but even they're changing. But if you look at areas of the city of Phoenix and also the rest of the valley that developed, let's say, after 1970,
mm-hmm.
you see vastly different neighborhood schematics. I mean, you can come to north parts of Phoenix and you see more xeriscape than not. That's not something that the city of Phoenix imposed upon development. It wasn't something that the city of Phoenix required, at least not initially. Now we are in a point where new development, you know, residential development, we are starting to look to limiting front yard grass, et cetera,
yeah.
and requiring non-native plants, et cetera. But these are things that we really pushed hard through public education, through messaging. And in some ways, maybe it's better that you don't remember the last time you saw a billboard because it's so ingrained, but without strenuous requirements. We might have to go there someday. I'm not going to say that's not possible.
Yeah.
But that's not where we want to start.
Okay. So it sounds like you are optimistic about the future of this city, even as we face this kind of dire future in terms of climate.
I definitely am. I think that Phoenix is in a position to be the most sustainable desert city on the planet. Hmm. With advanced water purification, with efficient use of water, I mean, we do have to be aware of things like urban heat. And I also should say, even though it's not something that's popular to say, there are limits, right? We have to recognize that there are limits on our water resources. At some point in time, you could push them to the point where you can't make new resources. We're going to come as close as we can on advanced water purification. But at some point in time, there is a limit unless something dramatically changed and we start importing water from another source, which people talk about.
Yeah.
But short of that, I mean, we do have to recognize that as long as there are limits, then we have to learn to live within our means, because it would be bad if we got to the point where we're using water in a way that's just not sustainable.
Okay. Cynthia Campbell, Water Resources Management Advisor for the City of Phoenix, joining us. Cynthia, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Lauren.
J.D. Vance was selected as Donald Trump's running mate in 2024 based partly on the reputation of his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. Last year, the show's Sam Dingman spoke with a writer who takes issue with Vance's portrayal of his background.
Vice President-elect J.D. Vance will take office after serving just 2 years in the Senate. He's only been a politician for a short time. Prior to his time in the Senate, he was best known as the author of a best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. The book came out in 2016, and it was a sensation. Many journalists, in particular, praised Vance for what seemed, to them, like an honest accounting of poverty in rural and Rust Belt parts of the country. A few years later, Hillbilly Elegy was adapted into a movie, directed by Ron Howard. The reputation Vance gained from the book played a significant role in his nomination for vice president. Supporters touted him as an ambassador for the downtrodden Americans of Appalachia and the Midwest. But Alyssa Court isn't so sure Vance is a reliable narrator. Court is the author of Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. That's a book that frames poverty as a systemic inequality issue, which differs significantly from Vance, who seems to view poverty as a personal crisis that can be overcome through sheer grit and gumption. When I spoke with Court last year, she told me that for her, the most telling scene in Hillbilly Elegy is one where Vance gets invited to a fancy law school dinner and he panics because he doesn't know which fork to use.
Because it was kind of a class anxiety. He's worrying about being judged by his fellow students, and he's up against what he doesn't know about upper middle class and upper class manners. And he wants it both ways. He'll say things like, "Poor people are my people." He said that in an interview. But then he has all this contempt. So he says things about people who are, you know, from the holler. You have to stop making excuses and take responsibility. And that is the mark of somebody who is all about where he's going rather than where he's been.
Yeah. Well, and it assumes that anybody who lives in a place like the one that he decided to leave wants the same things as him rather than to stay. And one of the things that you write about in the piece I read of yours on LitHub is that there are a great many writers about the Rust Belt and Appalachia and the working class more broadly who are doing so from those places, and that their writing about the experience of living in environments like that is very different than J.D. Vance's. So tell us what you see as the differences between the kind of writing that emerges from those places than writing like Vance's, which sort of looks back in anger, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, I divide it into two categories. One is the working class traitor, which is very much the Vance thing. And the other kind is the class defector. And those are people who leave their working class backgrounds. I'm thinking of a book like Milltown by Carrie Arsenal. These kind of books, the class defector changes their life and lives and goes to these, you know, nice colleges and becomes like a literary figure. But there's a lot of kind of love for where they came from, and also a critical perspective on the equivalent of the Ivy League that they wind up in. And I think that's one of the things that's strange to me about J.D. Vance's version of the world, that he doesn't seem to understand systemic poverty at all. So he doesn't have any forgiveness for the people that he lived amongst. But he also doesn't have any critical vision of the Peter Thiels, this wealthy Silicon Valley billionaire who's libertarian, that he is his mentor, that those people are blameless. And there's a long tradition behind this. I mean, so like a lot of the classics of American literature had this ideology. And in my book, I talk a lot about the lies that are underneath it, the ways in which all these different people actually received help, including J.D. Vance.
Yes. Well, one of the places that J.D. Vance got help from is the press. And as you write in this way, quote, Vance is our monster. So tell me a little bit about what you mean by that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Vance's story flatters in a certain way liberal critics. It soothes class privilege liberals because you read it and you think, you know, this is a rags to riches story. There's authenticity and realness. A lot of, you know, at this point, something like 73% of our journalists and critics are on the coasts. And that's the majority. And so they are open to this kind of fetishistic version of real American poverty. That's something out of the 1970s film Deliverance. And the fact that, you know, Vance keeps telling us that the people who don't make it out aren't trying hard enough is soothing because poverty is made into a form of immorality in American culture. And I think there is a problem with the press, that we have a press that's so privileged in a certain way, educationally privileged in particular, that they don't really understand what this world's like. So they're willing to sort of buy into these accounts.
Yeah.
Another funny phrase, somebody used pornography to describe the kind of thing that J.D. Vance writes.
Well, one of the things that makes me think about is, and tell me if you agree, when Hillbilly Elegy came out, much of the coverage from what you have called the progressive culture makers, who were kind of like reviewing and elevating this book, is that there was such a rush at the time amongst mainstream media outlets to understand, like, but who are these Trump voter people?
Yes.
Like, how could this have happened? And that much of the evaluation of Hillbilly Elegy, it seemed to me, was about making themselves feel better for now knowing who those people were, according to J.D. Vance, rather than making an effort to actually understand their perspective via a messenger other than somebody who, as you were pointing out, seems to have a good bit of contempt for that world and, in fact, left it far behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a cartoonish version, right? Mm-hmm. And that's comforting unto itself. You know, you don't really have to get to know it. I mean, one thing that I was thinking, though, is that I do think that there is a degree of trauma in J.D. Vance's account of where he's from. Like, he did have a hard time, seemingly. And
of course,
he had to separate himself from it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, you know, we are talking about a victim of pretty severe abuse. I don't think that it's irresponsible to use the word trauma to describe the environment that he grew up in. I mean, he was physically abused and psychologically abused by somebody who clearly was dealing with their own demons in the form of his mom.
And I don't mean to get into his head like a, you know, armchair psychiatrist, but it's a kind of human self-protective impulse, I think, to protect, you know, the dry land that you're on. Mm-hmm. And then you can sort of point fingers at people who are more vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, as a note to close on, one of my favorite parts of, again, that interview with you that I read is you said, quote, "It's really too bad that Hillbilly Elegy wasn't turned into something like Adaptation. Could you imagine if there was a meta version? How much better would it be if Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman made a version of Hillbilly Elegy?" And I could not help wondering how far you have taken that fantasy in your mind.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing. Ron Howard, right, from Happy Days, like the most all-American filmmaker, right, makes the movie version of Hillbilly Elegy, which was a total flop. But it cast, like, you know, Glenn Close, like all these incredible A-list actors. But it was taken totally straight, and these actors left their Tribeca and, you know, West Side LA apartments to put on a wig and pretend to be Meemaw, right? Mm-hmm. But I was like, what if they had a desperate screenwriter trying to imagine himself into Ohio and into Kentucky? Like, in a way, that would be more accurate. That would be verite. That would be like the honest to God. That was what, you know, Ron Howard leaving his, you know, meeting with a cappuccino, trying to figure out how to do a movie about Appalachia. So anyway, that is my fantasy.
Okay, I really hope that happens. Alyssa Quart is the author of Bootstrapped: Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Late last year, the TV company TCL held a movie premiere at one of the most well-known venues in LA. And the short films shown that day all had one thing in common. They were generated by artificial intelligence. Our next guest was at the premiere and says the films themselves were a bit odd. In one, a woman has a disease that turns her into a slug. In another, a real actor goes into an audition and is then deepfaked into famous movie scenes. But beyond the stories and plots, Jason Kebler says it was what he saw on screen that stood out to him. Kebler is the co-founder of 404 Media, a journalist-owned tech website. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with the fact that Kebler wasn't all that impressed with these short films visually.
Yeah, I mean, they have the same issues that most AI-generated content has. And by that, I mean text on, like, in the movie The Slug, there's a scene in the bath, and there's, like, these bath salts, and the words on the bath salt label turn into, like, alien symbols at some point. That happened in many of the films where, you know, it was part English, part, like, alien writing. A lot of the, like, lip syncing was really bad, where the audio didn't sync properly with the lips. You know, the characters often sort of weren't looking at each other when they were interacting with each other. And then when they were, like, walking around and things like that, sometimes it looked natural. Other times characters seemed to float and things like that. And I understand that the technology is in its infancy, but as a viewer, it really does sort of take you out of the experience.
Well, so from a technology standpoint, I understand that as an outsider, like, making sure that the dialogue and the mouth movement, the lip movement on the character might be difficult. But, like, how hard would it be to go in and just put some actual English letters on the canister of bath salts? Like, is that a technological challenge that the directors and the producers couldn't overcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is these films are part of an experiment that TCL is doing called TCL Film Machine, where they are trying to make AI-generated movies. And so I think that they didn't want to have that sort of human intervention. If you think about Hollywood in general, artificial intelligence is already used a lot in special effects, and you probably never would know it because it's blended with practical effects. It's, you know, very high budget stuff. And it is already sort of revolutionizing how these effects are done. And as a viewer, you might never notice. But in this case, I think part of the whole conceit was, how much of these films can we actually do with the AI tools that exist now? And the answer is, you can make a film, but it's going to have these problems.
Yeah. Well, and as you point out in your piece, there was a decent amount of human involvement in these films, right? It wasn't total AI.
Yeah, so all of the dialogue, like all of the scripts were written by humans. So these were not ChatGPT generated scripts. All of the voices were voiced by humans. All of the music was made by humans. And then a lot of the editing was done by humans. And part of this is because there's a big fear in Hollywood right now that AI is going to replace you know, human labor, and people are going to lose their jobs. And so I think TCL wanted to say, look, this is a tool that will augment what humans are already doing. And that may be the case for these early films, but I don't know if that's going to remain the case as this becomes more normalized across a variety of different studios.
Well, so as you say, this is obviously a significant issue in Hollywood and beyond Hollywood, sort of in the entertainment film industry broadly. I'm wondering what you take from this experiment and maybe can extrapolate out to the future of AI in movie making.
Yeah, so I was interested in this because I write about AI on the internet and how it's changing our world. And for every cool and interesting use of artificial intelligence, these tools sort of filter down to, I guess, what I would call bad actors, like spammers, scammers, things like that. And so the vast majority of AI-generated content that I see on the internet is AI deepfakes, disinformation, weird spam. And I think that context is very important because there are going to be studios that use artificial intelligence to make their movies better. And I'm not saying that that is necessarily a bad thing. But I think that something that's becoming really difficult is finding those high quality films or high quality writing or high quality music on the internet as we're just sort of getting spammed by low quality AI generated things. And I worry that that will happen with the movie industry as well.
Well, so what did TCL have to say about all this? Like, how do they think that this experiment will play into what the future of AI in the film industry might be?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I talked to one of their executives, and he said that TCL is sort of new to the content generation game. Like, they don't make a lot of original movies or TV shows, and so they don't have a lot of relationships in Hollywood. So there's not like people for them to upset with this. They're not going to ruin their relationships with writers, directors, and actors. So they feel sort of empowered to do this type of experimentation. But at the same time, the company did say at this premiere that they think that this type of content can be made more inexpensively than human-generated content, and that it can be used to fuel this, you know, advertising model where you are targeted with advertisements based on your viewing habits. I don't know. That's something that, as a sort of privacy reporter, that I am very concerned about. But I think that's sort of the market opportunity that they see.
So which do you think is the bigger impediment to overcome if companies would like to produce fully AI movies, the actual technology of doing it or the response slash backlash of people who, you know, will either watch them or not watch them?
I think that the technology is still a big hurdle, and it's not necessarily the technology, but I think it's the creativity. The actor Ben Affleck had a really great answer. He was asked a similar question recently, and, you know, AI is very good at some of the technical aspects of movie making, and I despite the shortcomings that we've just talked about, those are being worked on. But AI is not that good at coming up with brand new ideas, and I think that the creativity of writing, the creativity of acting, the emotion of acting, there's still something very human about that, of course. And I think that audiences can tell. I think that studios probably still value the human aspect of this. And even if there's not a specific backlash to the technology, I think that there's like something almost subconscious about it where there's this uncanny valley effect and something seems off about fully AI generated things. And so I do think that humans are going to need to continue to be very involved and will make the best art.
That was Jason Kebler speaking with my co-host, Mark Brody, about AI films. He is the co-founder of 404 Media. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.